KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The reality of President Trump's expanding trade war is setting in. We speak with Senator Alyssa Slotkin about how it's affecting her home state of Michigan, where car factories are already furloughing workers. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump fired national security staffers and questioned their loyalty after he met with far-right activist Laura Loomer. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. What do we know about the people influencing the president? Also, how Elton John and Brandi Carlile put together a new album in just 20 days. It's Friday, April 4th. Do spoilers count after more than 100 years? Because on this day, in 1841, Edgar Allan Poe published what's considered the first detective story. The culprit was... Oops, I ran out of time. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stock markets are extending their plunge for a second day as investors continue to react to President Trump's worldwide tariffs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 1,400 points, or about 3.5%. The NASDAQ is off about 4.5%. Investors appear to be shaking off a strong report from the Labor Department this morning that found 228,000 new jobs were created last month. That's far stronger than expected. However, President Trump's 10% tariffs will start to take effect tomorrow. China is facing more levies than that. Now, as NPR's John Ruwitch reports, China says it will retaliate.
In coordinated statements, government ministries laid out the details of China's retaliation, which sharply escalates the trade war between the world's two biggest economies. The finance ministry will impose a 34% tariff on all U.S. imports. That's the same rate that the Trump administration imposed on China during Wednesday's so-called Liberation Day global tariff blitz. China's tariffs take effect on April 10th. The Ministry of Commerce is adding 16 U.S. entities to an export control list and 11 to a so-called unreliable entities list, effectively blacklisting them. It also said it's imposing export controls on a handful of rare earth minerals, making it harder for American companies to buy them. And China's Customs Department is suspending farm product import qualifications for several American companies. John Ruwitch, NPR News, Beijing.
NATO foreign ministers are meeting in Brussels. President Trump has demanded that NATO member nations pay up to 5% of their gross domestic product toward NATO. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is at the meeting, and he's doubled down on that point.
We want NATO to be stronger. We want NATO to be more viable. And the only way NATO can get stronger and more viable is if our partners, the nation states that comprise this important alliance, have more capability.
NATO allies say they're open to boosting defense spending, but they're also worried about President Trump's warm relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The cuts are not over at the Department of Health and Human Services. After laying off thousands of staff members this week, the health agency is cutting spending on contracts. NPR's Sydney Lupkin explains.
HHS will cut spending on contracts by 35% across all federal health agencies. That includes the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Andrew Nixon, a spokesman for the department, confirmed the spending cuts to NPR. He says they're part of an initiative to cut, quote, unnecessary spending. According to its contracting website, HHS says it considers contractors as partners, but they have to meet strict acquisition rules and performance and transparency goals. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks continued to drop, about 1,200 points lower for the Dow, about 600 points lower for the NASDAQ. You're listening to NPR. Two prominent congressional Democrats say that the director of the National Security Agency and his deputy have been fired by President Trump. NSA Chief Air Force General Timothy Hawk led the NSA for just over a year. The security agency has declined to comment on his dismissal or that of his deputy, Wendy Noble, who is a civilian. The move came just hours after Trump also fired several members of his National Security Council. People in states from Texas to Pennsylvania are getting ready for potentially historic levels of flooding in the coming hours and days. NPR's Kristen Wright reports on the multiple rounds of severe weather.
describing it as life-threatening and catastrophic. Forecasters say it could end up being the worst flooding many communities have seen in a generation. The National Weather Service says it's going to keep raining all weekend in the Mid-South and Ohio Valley, the same places hit by intense storms already this week. Seven people were killed by tornadoes in Missouri, Indiana, and Tennessee. East of Memphis, more rain is expected in the town of Selmer, hit by a devastating tornado Thursday. Widespread flood alerts are in place throughout the region, and as many as 10 to 15 inches of rain could fall in some areas. Tornadoes and large hail are also possible. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
The women's NCAA college basketball Final Four games are set for tonight in Tampa. South Carolina will meet Texas. After that, UCLA will take on UConn. The men's Final Four games will start tomorrow in San Antonio, Texas. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldel. Coming up, how President Trump's tariffs are felt in the automaking state of Michigan. We talk with Democratic Senator Alyssa Slotkin. But first, the director of the National Security Agency and head of U.S. Cyber Command, General Timothy Hawk, has been fired. This, according to top Democrats on congressional intelligence committees, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia and Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut.
The New York Times and the Washington Post are reporting that the firing is in connection to a meeting between President Trump and far-right activist Laura Loomer, during which she advocated for their dismissal. Now, I want to mention here that NPR has not independently verified this. A number of National Security Council staffers have also been fired, and President Trump is downplaying that move. Here he is talking on Air Force One last night.
Always we let people that we don't like or people that we don't think can do the job, or people that may have loyalties to somebody else. You'll always have.
Here with more on the NSC firings is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. So what do we know about these firings?
Well, Trump confirmed that there were firings at the NSC for what we don't know exactly, and the NSC said it wouldn't comment on personnel matters. But all this came after Trump met with Loomer. You know, she's someone who was close to Trump during the 2024 campaign, which raised some eyebrows even among those on the right, because, you know, she's someone who's peddled conspiracy theories or misinformation about everything from COVID to the 2017 mass shooting in Las Vegas and the attempted assassination of Trump. You know, she's called herself pro-white nationalist and a white advocate, written racist things about Muslims and former Vice President Kamala Harris that I won't repeat, applauded the deaths of immigrants, and a whole lot of other stuff. You know, Trump denied that Loomer was the reason for the firings. He said that she recommended additions, but Loomer herself posted on X, one of the many platforms that she'd been banned from before Elon Musk bought it, that she did report people to Trump who she sees as disloyal to him, not necessarily to the country or Constitution. The NSA director and his deputy are among the people she called disloyal people, her evidence being that they were, she says, recommended by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, who broke with Trump and called him a fascist.
Okay, so what's going on here? What's this all about?
Well, this is the kind of thing Loomer does. You know, she's very online, far-right activist, bills herself as a, quote, investigative journalist. But what that means is that she goes through people's social media history, their backgrounds, and connects dots that are often in conspiratorial ways and puts it all out there. In this case, Trump seemed to be taking Loomer's word over even his national security advisor, Mike Waltz. The New York Times reported that Waltz briefly defended his staff, but, quote, it was clear he had little, if any, power to protect their jobs. Remember, it was Waltz or someone on his staff who inadvertently added that report to signal chat group in the first place.
That's right. So what does this say about the people Trump is surrounding himself with and who has influence over him?
Yeah, it's always a question with every president who they're listening to, who their advisors are. What this tells us is this is a very different group of people around Trump now than in his first term. You know, then there were more established, experienced people, but he really soured on those kinds of folks and moved more toward people in the right-wing ecosphere of Trump acolytes and devotees that cropped up with him out of office. And the thing is, on any given day, you just don't know who's in Trump's ear or who he's seeking out, someone with more Washington experience or someone like Loomer, and that makes for a very chaotic and destabilizing White House.
That's NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thank you, Domenico.
Thank you.
Now to President Trump's tariffs. The impact is already being felt in the car and auto parts industry. Stellantis, which makes Jeep and Chrysler, just announced what they call a temporary layoff of 900 workers across five U.S. plants. That includes factories in Michigan, a state where the auto industry still drives the economy and where voters helped elect President Trump, as well as our next guest, Democratic Senator Alyssa Slotkin. And she's with us now to give us her take on all this that's happening. Senator, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So before we talk about tariffs, though, I do want to note that before you were elected to Congress, you had a career in national security. You served in the CIA and the Defense Department dealing with what you've noted were sensitive matters from fighting ISIS to confronting Russian aggressing. So what are your thoughts on what appears to be a significant shakeup in the country's national security team? I mean, this team, after all, is charged with briefing the president regularly.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think what people don't understand about national security is people who go into that profession, especially in uniform, right? They fire generals, senior, very senior generals. They go into it because they want to protect the country. They do not have loyalty to one political party. They come in, they do their job every day, they keep their heads down, and they protect American citizens from things they have no idea are happening, threats they have no idea are happening. General Hawk has come and briefed us many times on the Armed Services Committee in private and public session. And I think it's just another example how they're putting politics at the Trump White House ahead of the security of people. And it's offensive, right? It seems like this woman came in, this white nationalist conspiracy theorist came in, told the president that there's a bunch of bad guys who are serving for him, and then they were out and within a week. And on top of that, it distracts from, obviously, their own mistakes and what went on with the signal chain last week. But it's just another way that they're politicizing the uniformed military and making American citizens less safe with these arbitrary firings.
So now to the tariffs. What are you hearing from your home state, especially from auto workers, since we're hearing that people are already being laid off?
Yeah, I think I can't overstate the level of sort of instability and open questions about the future. To me, it's the same level of uncertainty from our business leaders, our auto workers, our farmers that we had during COVID 5 years ago, where you kind of don't know what's going to happen next. Obviously, on the manufacturing side, you know, we are trying to understand what this is going to do, but I think it's hard to say that it won't do anything other than raise prices of cars. And we have already seen layoffs in Stellantis, and but for me, we haven't yet seen the next chess moves from the other countries, right? China just this morning announced what their retaliation is. All these other countries are about to announce their retaliation, and they get to pick and choose where it hurts us most. And so I'm very concerned about our farmers, which is a big part of our industry in Michigan. And look, Trump did this in his first administration, right? I live on my family farm. We lease our farm to a soybean farmer. soybeans were targeted in the tariff war in the first Trump administration. We've never made up market share from the markets we lost. China just stopped buying from us, and they went to Brazil and to Argentina. We just permanently lost that market. So we're waiting for the next shoe to drop, but it's a lot of instability.
Now, you supported a resolution in the Senate to revoke the tariffs on Canadian goods. It did get some bipartisan support, but it's non-binding, and it's unlikely to see a vote in the House. So what's the next move? I mean, Congress is supposed to play a role in trade policy. The workaround for this administration has been by declaring it an emergency. But what's the next move? Are you trying to persuade more of your colleagues that this isn't good economic policy, it's not truly an emergency? What's the next step here?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, I think everyone understands we need a 21st century trade policy. What's working right now, and there are plenty of countries that are cheating in the international system, particularly China. We understand that. I think it's just doing it strategically and responsibly and not this, like, kind of slapstick way that they're doing it that risks raising prices and hurting the economy. You're right. We passed this resolution. It was a non-binding resolution, but can we just take a note? It was the first time that anything has passed in the House that pushes back on Trump's policies since he was sworn in. We did it with Democrats and Republicans. Republicans voted with Democrats on this, and I think that it's instructive that the first time we push back on Trump, it's over his, you know, sort of policy of kicking our allies in the teeth, particularly Canada. What's interesting is that Senator Grassley, a Republican, has now put forward a piece of legislation that would say, you know what, Congress needs a bigger role in this because the way you're doing this, you're threatening our economy. That's a Republican putting that forward.
So my question is, are you trying to persuade your colleagues or are you trying to persuade voters that they need to be more vocal in pushing back on this? I have to note that the tariffs are being pitched as a way to bring jobs back to the United States. We know that President Trump made inroads with union voters in his last campaign, including in your state. So my question is your main goal or task right now to persuade your colleagues that this is bad economic policy or to persuade voters that they need to be more vocal that this is hurting them?
Well, I think, look, the voters are going to, they understand their own pocketbooks. They may not understand the federal budget and all the ins and outs of all these things. They understand the price of a car. They understand the price of milk and coffee and sugar. They understand the basic things in their lives. So we're going to see. We're going to see in the next couple of weeks what this does. No one wants anything other than to bring jobs back home, but people need some predictability. Things don't flip overnight. You know, if China just today put a huge retaliatory tariff on rare earth minerals, we just don't dig a lot of rare earth minerals out of the ground in the United States of America. I mean, that doesn't happen overnight. So I think people are going to start to feel that pain. And again, no one wants that. We don't want a recession. We don't want that pain. We want jobs back. And a strategic policy does that, not this kind of slapstick approach.
So two more questions for you. What in your state, what sectors are you most concerned about?
Well, look, we have the auto sector, obviously. People forget, you know, we have tier one, tier two, tier three suppliers, mom and pop shops that make widgets that go in cars. They're also deeply worried, particularly the smaller ones, that they're going to go out of business. And I'm worried about the farming section of our economy. They were the ones who paid the brunt of the pain last time. I think that's poised to happen again. But look, even things like medical devices, big MRI machines in our hospitals, those are things we could see that become much more expensive and unable for our hot. They're the ones talking to me about that. So I think we have to see the second and third order effects. It's going to affect a lot of our country and our state.
And as briefly as you can, what's your message in this moment to voters who say that they might be feeling the pain now, but believe that the president, when he says this will be better in the long run? Do you have a message for that?
Yeah, my message is we all want jobs to come back home. But we have to do it in a strategic way, and we're going to see. People know their own budgets. They're not stupid. They're going to know whether this is going to help in the medium term, in the long term, or not. So let the proof be in the pudding.
That is Senator Alyssa Slotkin. She is a Democrat from Michigan. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The TV series The Office is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. On the next Fresh Air, interviews with the creator and writer Greg Daniels and cast members Steve Carell, Mindy Kaling, Jenna Fischer, John Krasinski, and Rainn Wilson. And co-creator and star of the original British version, Ricky Gervais. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Almost as soon as Elton John began recording his latest album, he started blowing the whole thing up. You see, a couple of years ago, he and his longtime lyricist, Bernie Taupin, reached out to Americana singer-songwriter Brandi Carlile and proposed making an album together in just 20 days.
We went with Andrew Watt, the producer, Brandi, Bernie Taupin, and myself. We had nothing. But that was what excited me. I didn't want to know what was going to happen. I was wanting to be unprepared and have a big adventure.
It's hard to overstate the amount of pressure I had put on myself around making this album with him.
Those recordings are out today. It's called Who Believes in Angels. Even though Sir Elton calls this one of the greatest experiences he's had in recent years in the studio, the first few sessions were a disaster. It's the first time Elton John ever let a camera crew document his writing and recording process. And what's stunning to see is the Elton John was a nervous wreck.
The fear led to a lot of me having self-doubt about my writing, about what the album should be like, and I didn't have much energy. I was kind of ornery for the first 5 or 6 days, to put it mildly. And a couple of times I thought, I don't know whether we should continue with this. But it finally fell into place. And once it fell into place, it just went ahead like a rocket.
Elton said that you were a bit ornery. I watched the trailer for the upcoming documentary about the making of the album. You slammed your headphones, you ripped up paper, you threatened to leave.
Just keep it.
Dude, I'm just trying to make the song as best as it can be. You're so impatient.
Nightmare. The frustrations that I had were mostly frustrations about my own ability to get the lyric right or the melody right or get the harmony right or just, you know, am I doing the right thing? I mean, doubt is something I had at the start of this album. And if you don't have doubt, then you shouldn't be there because you're coasting. You never should coast. I've never coasted, and I didn't want this album to sound like any other Elton John album that I've done, and it doesn't. Don't hide yourself away. Don't go hard from what you deserve. You gotta break your heart wide open. Let a little light into the world.
The first song that we wrote and recorded didn't make the album, and it actually wasn't that great of a song. And when we came in on the second day and the producer played it back for us, I watched Elton do something I've never been brave enough to do, which was the song ended and Elton looks at me and Bernie and Andrew and he goes, I hate it.
Ooh.
And then he goes, I won't be continuing.
Yeah.
And I remember I died in that moment, but then I thought to myself in the days after, I thought, actually it wasn't good. Why wasn't anybody brave enough to say they hate it except him?
And I did hate it. And unless it wasn't the record that I want to make, it sounded like it could have been a track on an album 10, 20 years ago. That wasn't for me.
Wow. Now, Brandi, the song Swing for the Fences, tell us about that one. That one, I read that you felt like that was your gem that you were going to bring to this whole thing.
I mean, it's a love letter to LGBTQ youth, but it is also a thank you letter to Elton. He really wanted me to write a rock and roll song. He really wanted it to be positive and uplifting and exciting. It was like the only one song that felt like an assignment to me, you know? And I just wanted him to love it so bad. And it's the first song that I brought to him in the studio was that one.
Ellen, what did you think of that song, Swing for the Fences, when you first heard it and saw it?
I went, hallelujah. She finally got it. Hallelujah. This is what I've been wanting her to do for a long time. This is what I wanted to make the album for, because I knew you could do something like this.
Elton, it seems like mortality comes up quite a bit on this album, either accepting the end of things or maybe fighting to enjoy the days we have left.
Uh-huh.
And I got to admit, when I turned 50 a few years ago, I've never heard the clock tick in my head before.
Yeah.
Now I can actually hear it once in a while. Was that a theme you were consciously trying to include here? I mean, I think of the song, When This Old World Is Done With Me.
No, not really. The song that Bernie gave me, I was halfway through the lyric and the verse, and then I got to the chorus and found out what it was about, and then I broke down. When this old world is done to me, just know I came this far to be broken up in pieces, scatter me among the stars. I think when you get to a certain age, you think about mortality, and if you have children and a family, and you know, you think about it. But I'm not a gloom and doom person. I think I have so much more time on this planet. I'm in good shape, I'm in good health. But there is a time when we do think about, you know, what's going to happen? How are they going to be if I'm not here? Blah, blah, blah. And it's just a human thought.
Yeah.
Death is a part of life. Mm. It's important to sing about it, but I've never sung about it so meaningfully as this song. Release me like an ocean wave. Return me to the tide.
Brandy, is there anything that came out of this process that maybe makes you a better songwriter?
Oh, my God. I was recently writing for a new Brandy Carlile album and missing Elton so much. But knowing and remembering that the Elton music and what I witnessed in the studio live is a well that I'm always going to be able to draw from.
That's Elton John and Brandy Carlile. Their new album of duets is called Who Believes in Angels. Elton, Brandy, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
What a blast. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It's been 50 years since the founding of Microsoft, the company that jump-started the personal computing revolution.
Oh, I immediately think of Windows and Office. I think of the system that, by the end of the 1990s, was running on nearly every single desktop computer in the world.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We look at the last half century of the tech giant that changed the world on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
President Trump's applauding today's jobs report. Last month, the economy gained a much greater than expected 228,000 jobs. The unemployment rate ticked up to 4.2%. However, official numbers have yet to reflect the full scope of DOGE-driven mass layoffs across the federal government. Fed Chair Jerome Powell is expected to speak today about the economic outlook. This week, President Trump unveils sweeping tariffs that he says will place U.S. industries on a stronger footing. NPR's Alina Selyukh reports many retailers, including small business owners, say they plan on retrenching and scaling back.
Maybe your store shrinks the selection, so there's less stuff to ship. Maybe you stop hiring, stop advertising or developing new products, stop growing and go into survival mode. And the other answer is raising prices. Giant companies like Walmart might pressure suppliers overseas to bear some of the tariff costs. Well, small suppliers don't really have that kind of muscle.
NPR's Alina Selyukh. U.S. stock markets are extending a second day of steep declines in the wake of U.S. tariffs and retaliatory responses from other countries, including China, the world's second largest economy after the U.S., says it is imposing a 34% tariff on all American goods. This hour, all major market indices are down more than 3%. The Dow down more than 1,300 points. This is NPR News. Severe weather, including tornadoes, is linked to at least 8 deaths now across the Midwest and South, most in Tennessee. NOAA forecaster David Roth is tracking flood threats.
There's an extensive area of flash flood warnings from northwest Tennessee across over half of Kentucky currently. The rainfall that's occurred over the past 24 to 36 hours is getting to be pretty significant for this part of the country. There's some radar estimates near 9 inches now since the rain began across portions of western Kentucky.
A senior Kremlin envoy is calling this week's meetings with Trump administration officials in Washington constructive and yielded positive dynamics. Talks came as Russia was notably absent from a White House list of countries on the receiving end of new tariffs. Here's NPR's Charles Maines.
The White House says Russia avoided the tariffs because the country is already sanctioned by the U.S. over its actions in Ukraine. And President Trump has threatened to impose additional penalties on Russian oil exports if he doesn't see more progress from Moscow towards U.S.-backed efforts to secure a peace deal. Yet the Kremlin's envoy, Kirill Dmitriev, said discussions with White House officials focused on future U.S.-Russian cooperation, including joint development of Russia's Arctic, mineral extraction, even restored air travel. Speaking to the press, Dmitriev argued economic cooperation and continued dialogue offered the best way to resolve geopolitical differences, including over Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. It's a difficult time to be a college president. A federal task force is reviewing billions of dollars in Harvard University's funding. A similar probe is underway at Columbia, where the interim president just stepped down after less than 8 months on the job. Vice President J.D. Vance has said universities are the enemy and should be attacked. And President Trump is prepared to withhold federal financial aid if colleges don't comply with a number of executive orders and policy changes. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny has been talking to the people who run colleges and university this week, and here she is.
In a typical year, leading a university is still a pretty complex job. There are worries of enrollment declines, cuts in state funding, upset faculty, and in recent years, a global pandemic that closed many campuses. But in the last few weeks, things have felt really different.
This is a really, really challenging time for American higher education.
It feels like you have to be the calm in the center of a storm.
It can feel like a lot of abuse is being hurled at college and university presidents.
You just heard Andrew Martin at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, Mary Dana Hinton at Hollins University in Virginia, and Suzanne Rivera from McAllister College in Minnesota. One president described the current climate to me like a gladiator match where colleges are being sent into the pit for entertainment.
I served 38 years in the Navy. I flew in 125 under fire combat missions.
Ted Carter is the president of The Ohio State University.
People ask me all the time, do I miss flying? And I say, no, the job that I'm in right now is as dynamic as it can be without actually being fired at.
In just the last few weeks, Ohio State has lost about $4 million from federal funding cuts to grants and programs. It's among dozens of institutions under federal investigation for allegedly failing to protect Jewish students from discrimination. Ohio State denies any wrongdoing. And like many universities, Carter closed their Office of Diversity and Inclusion, which has been open since 1970.
It was hard. It's difficult. A decision that nobody wants to make. I don't believe you have to have a centralized office under these categories to still be able to do that work. Kind of like in the Top Gun Maverick movie, we have to still know how to play defense and offense at the same time.
Playing offense means traveling to Washington to meet with congressional leaders. Nearly every president I talked to said that is part of what they're doing right now, trying to strengthen their relationship with people in power and to communicate that universities are essential for the economy and the nation. Andrew Martin is the chancellor of Washington University in St. Louis, a private university with more than $1 billion in federal support for its research, much of it in health and science. He says cuts in funding don't just hurt students, they hurt local communities.
When we build buildings, that keeps people in the trades employed.
The university, like many across the country, is the second largest employer in St. Louis, employing tens of thousands of people.
If the university is under great financial pressure, some of those jobs, unfortunately, are going to have to go away.
Many colleges have had to cut jobs. Last month, Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore eliminated more than 2,000 positions. College presidents I talk to say their group chats with other presidents light up daily, sometimes hourly. They're working closely with legal counsel to make sure they're following changes to the law. And they're watching what's happening to Columbia and Penn and Harvard and are afraid they could be next.
I have moments when the fear really does bubble up, and I think that's real.
Mary Dana Hinton is the president of Hollins University in Virginia. She says she is, of course, stressed about losing financial aid dollars or removing the word diversity from their website, but she's been thinking deeply about how she needs to promote academic freedom and protect her students' ability to disagree and think differently, even if it's at odds with government leaders.
It feels like every minute of the day, what am I going to stand for? Every minute I'm having to remind myself, I and my fellow college presidents, this is what we are called to do.
Anytime I'm having a bad day over some of the things that we're talking about here, all I need to do is go engage with a group of students, and then my faith is renewed.
President Carter at The Ohio State University says he always goes back to the students.
They're the ones that should be able to answer the question, are you being indoctrinated? And the answer is, of course, no. We don't teach students what to think. We teach them how to think.
Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Washington.
Americans have a lot of health care debt. A charity is buying up a mountain of that debt, wiping out billions. But even backers say it's not enough. Noam Levy with our partner KFF Health News has this report.
Undo Medical Debt is a New York charity that pioneered a strategy a decade ago to use private donations and government funding to buy up old debts and relieve them. The group just made its biggest purchase ever, a deal worth $30 billion. Allison Sesso leads the group, which used to be called RIP Medical Debt.
You've also got to help people who are under the weight of the broken systems today. These individuals cannot wait for change.
This deal will retire unpaid bills for an estimated 20 million people. These are folks with low and moderate incomes. The debts average about $1,100. That means people won't be targeted by collectors, and their debt won't be sold to other debt companies. Undo Medical Debt bought the old bills from Pendrick Capital Partners, a Virginia-based company. Sesso says the debt trader is closing down.
This was a really great opportunity to get a debt buyer out of the market.
That's one less collector that might call you when you have a medical bill you can't pay. It's not a system-wide fix, but Dr. Naaman Shah says it can be very helpful. He's led an initiative at the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health to tackle medical debt.
It's easy to criticize Band-Aids when you're not the one who's cut. As a physician, I take care of people who have cuts and know the importance of stitching them back up.
The strategy of retiring medical debt has been controversial, though.
The approach is just treating the symptoms and not the disease.
That's Elizabeth Benjamin at the Community Service Society of New York, a nonprofit that's championed tougher medical debt laws in the state. She says strong rules can stop hospitals from leaving so many people in debt in the first place.
Don't sue patients under 400% of poverty. Don't work out payment plans that are untenable for people. Offer financial assistance like you're supposed to under federal and state laws.
Here's another thing about buying up old medical debt. It's never enough. Americans borrowed an estimated $74 billion to pay for health care in the past year alone, a recent survey found. So even a big deal only makes a small dent in the problem. Allison Sesso of Undo Medical Debt acknowledges much more has to be done.
We don't think that the way we finance healthcare is sustainable. It's really a national problem that has to be solved on a national level.
Right now, some states are doing much less than others to protect their residents. In the latest deal, about half of the 20 million people getting debt relief live in just two states, Texas and Florida. Neither of these states has bolstered its healthcare safety net by guaranteeing Medicaid coverage for its low-income residents. And good health insurance is one of the best protections against medical debt. In Washington, D.C., I'm Noam Levy.
Noam is with our partner, KFF Health News. This is NPR News.
President Trump's new tariffs hit China hard, but he also levied these import taxes on goods from Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. The tariffs in Asia next time, here and now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. Victus Sports outside Philadelphia was not expecting their torpedo bats to go viral until the Yankees hit 9 homers in a single game last week, with some players using those bats that look like bowling pins. Now even seniors in local leagues want one. Victus says it's churned out hundreds this week and even made a rush delivery Monday to the Philly Stadium minutes before the first pitch. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. OMG! LOL! Exclamation marks. The way brands speak to us has changed a lot in just the last decade. Darian Woods, host of the Indicator podcast from Planet Money, experienced this when ordering a pair of chino pants recently. Woods and co-host Adrian Ma have more.
So the other day, Adrian, I bought some extremely ordinary pants. They were plain navy chinos from J.Crew.
As opposed to unusual pants?
They were not going to win any awards for novelty.
Okay, so you were in the market for some classic, you know, preppy American clothes at reasonable prices.
When my order arrived, I got this email. Subject line, best news ever, your order has arrived. Psst, check your mailbox. Doorstep. Wherever. And there are 3 exclamation marks here. We hope you really, really love it.
Wow, that's like uncomfortably personal tone to take from like a marketing email.
It would make sense if it was like selling ice cream or something, yeah. But it was just kind of incongruous to what I thought the brand was about.
This is something that I've been calling your cool friend, TM.
So brand strategist Joe Burns thinks J.Crew is part of a wider plague.
It's a tone of voice, a type of personality that more and more brands are adopting. They're trying to make it feel that, you know, they're just relatable. They're your friend, but slightly cooler. The coolest one of your friends is what they want to be.
Your cool friend, TM.
Every brand speaking like it's your cool best friend.
You go back 10 years, you'd have brands like Old Spice being this kind of crazy dude on a horse.
Hello, ladies. Look at your man. Now back to me. Now back at your man. Now back to me. Sadly,
or you'd have one of my favorite brands, The Economist. You know, they had this really austere tone of voice with, you know, it kind of sounded like an MBA grad who's read a dozen books before breakfast.
Good evening.
Good evening. It's Henry Kissinger. Ready for a good chat.
Brands used to have a tone of voice that was designed to be distinctive and to cut through and to be really noticeable to consumers.
Yeah, and then came social media and the rise of your cool best friend, TM.
All of this, I think, started off with the likes of Wendy's. So Wendy's on Twitter were one of the first brands to really employ this tone.
Around 2017, Wendy's ditched its polite corporate voice on Twitter. It roasted customers and started talking trash to McDonald's in the comments.
Yeah, so like a customer would tweet, "Is it shameful to be eating Wendy's food while sitting in a McDonald's parking lot?" And Wendy's would tweet back, "You're probably raising the property value, TBH."
Is this cool or is this just kind of like snarky?
It's snarky and cool.
Now, Joe, he says he isn't criticizing the pioneers of this voice.
But what I do feel like is that this tone of voice has become so pervasive, it's kind of become the new generic and it's lost its cool edge because every brand starts to speak like that.
Joe thinks this kind of witty tone became popular with brands because it boosts its ability to get shares and likes and reposts on social media.
What does immediately very well, it tends to be that relatable tone of voice. The problem there is you're already talking to an audience who's engaged with your brand, but there isn't necessarily the data that backs up that that tone of voice is going to also work for new customers too.
We're your cool friends. I'm Adrian Ma.
And I'm Darian Woods. Also your friend. Questionable though whether I'm cool. NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faudel. Two-time Costa Rican President Oscar Arias Sanchez won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1987 for his role in promoting an end to the civil wars devastating Central America. He was president between 1986 and 1990 and again between 2006 and 2010, holding firm against President Ronald Reagan, who backed the right-wing Contra militias in their war against the government of Nicaragua. Arias, at 84 and a longtime supporter of democracy, has also been a vocal critic of President Trump's policies. I spoke with him through an interpreter, NPR's Obed Manuel, after Arias got the news that his U.S. visa was revoked.
I received an email on Tuesday, it was a very short one, that said that my B1, B2 visa had been revoked. So what I did was I called the embassy to ask what had happened.
And what did they say?
They asked me to come into the embassy. Fortunately, I live about 5 minutes away, so I was able to be there in person, where they somewhat explained what happened.
And what did they say?
They told me my visa was revoked because of my close ties to China. During my second administration from 2006 to 2010, I established diplomatic relations with China. And that's because it has the second largest economy in the world. Costa Rica has a very open economy, and its growth relies on international trade. And so in 2007 is when we formally established diplomatic relations.
How much do you think your public statements criticizing President Trump, comparing him to a Roman emperor, played in them suspending your visa?
I don't know. The embassy workers didn't say that was specifically why my visa was revoked, and they cited my relationship with China. But I have to imagine that my criticism of President Trump might have played a role. The president has a personality that is not open to criticism or disagreements.
The Trump administration says it's targeting anyone they deem as having what they define as a, quote, hostile attitude, unquote, to the U.S. What do you make of that policy?
I don't have a hostile attitude towards the United States.
At this point in our conversation, Arias switched from his native Spanish to English.
Friends sometimes agree, sometimes disagree.
and concerning U.S. policy towards Central America, supporting militarily the Contras, affects my own country, Costa Rica. During the Reagan administration, I had a strong disagreement with his policy towards the region. But concerning my feelings towards the U.S., you know, my two children were educated in the U.S. My son went to Harvard and my daughter went to Boston College. I received more or less 85 honorary degrees from the best universities in the U.S. I am a good friend, but I also have fought for noble causes.
I mean, what does it say, though? I think there's so much fascination with your case because you're such a known figure. And yet your visa was revoked. So what does that say about the policy of the U.S. today under this administration?
Well, I don't agree with it. For a Democrat, and I am a true Democrat, criticism is welcome. It's the only way how you can build agreements. This happened to me when I met with the five Central American presidents in August of 87. I had introduced my peace plan. In the U.S., it was called the Arias Peace Plan. From a negotiation, you never get what you want. You always get what you can. And with criticism from adversaries or from the press and freedom of the press and freedom of opinion and freedom of expression is a prerequisite for any democratic government. So I have benefited myself with criticism from all those sources. And it seems to me that nowadays, one shouldn't dare to criticize the U.S. because could be punished.
Nobel Peace Prize laureate and former Costa Rican President Oscar Arias Sanchez, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We asked the State Department about this case, and we got a statement saying it doesn't discuss the details of individual cases. In this moment, who feels empowered to speak freely? Who feels silenced? And how has that changed over time? Next week on Morning Edition, listen as we examine the state of the First Amendment, the right from which all rights flow. Coverage starts Monday.
Hey, Layla.
Yeah.
Have you ever wondered what sound a shark makes?
No, not really.
Okay, well, here you go.
Oh, that clicking you hear, it's the rig shark from New Zealand. It's only about 5 feet long. And scientists at the University of Auckland believe this may be the first ever recording of a shark making noise.
Actually, the discovery itself was purely accidental.
That's Caroline Nieder. She's a marine biologist. She had been studying how sharks hear.
For me, coming from the field of fish bioacoustics, I didn't expect sharks to make sounds at all.
Then one day, while observing rig sharks, she heard a clicking sound coming from the shark, like a crackle of electricity.
I was like, oh my God, I think they're making some sounds.
Nieder and her team observed 10 rig sharks in tanks with microphones.
They noticed that whenever a shark was held, it would start clicking, maybe a stress response.
Nieder says the findings published last week in the journal Royal Society Open Science add a layer of complexity to already mysterious creatures.
There are 500 species of sharks, and a lot of people are only aware of the top 2 to 3 that, you know, come in encounters, negative or positive, with humans. This little shark is an example of the many sharks that are not known at all.
Nieder hopes the study will encourage people to learn more.
I hope it gives some curiosity to people about sharks and sound, things that they hadn't considered before. Maybe prompt people to listen to sharks in the wild, you know?
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Man, what's the matter with that cat there?
Must be full of reefer.
Full of reefers?
Yeah, man.
You mean that cat's high?
Sailing
lightly. Get away from here. Man, is that the reefer, man?
That's the reefer, man.
I believe he's losing his mind.
I think he's lost his mind.
Talking to that.